Hey everyone, and welcome to this episode of A Walk on the Wild Side, a veterinary podcast. This podcast is designed to educate veterinary professionals and other animal lovers on all things involving wildlife, zoo, aquatic, and zoologic companion animals. I'm your host, Dr. Kyle Kansman, a veterinary graduate from Michigan State University and a current veterinary intern at Colorado State University. Today, I'll be talking with the incredible Dr. Bree Talbot, a wildlife veterinarian working at Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital, which is Australia's largest mobile wildlife hospital. On this episode, Dr. Talbot will take us through the story behind the birth of Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital, and then we'll discuss the effects of natural disasters on wildlife and the critical role of wildlife rehabilitation, with a primary focus on the bushfires that have devastated Australia. All right, let's jump right into the episode. Hey, Dr. Talbot, such an incredible pleasure to have you on this episode of A Walk on the Wild Side.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being on here.
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, why don't you tell us a little bit, for those listening, just about yourself, what kind of work that you've done, and how you found yourself into the position you are in today?
So I've been a vet now for about 10 or so years, and my passion was always in zoo and wildlife medicine. But getting into zoo medicine, as probably a lot of you know, is quite difficult. And so I sort of started off in mixed practice, so working with small and large animals, because, you know, working with a horse or cow is sort of the same as working with a giraffe or an elephant. So I thought I was going to get, you know, into that kind of training. But when I started to do this mixed practice, I realized that our wildlife, they weren't getting the treatment that they deserved. And so the practice that I worked in did see a large caseload of wildlife. And so I started to do, you know, sort of the wildlife work that was coming in, and I really enjoyed it. And sort of, you know, trying to still get into the zoo world was, you know, a bit hard, because in Australia it's a very small pool of zoos that you can work in. So I decided to kind of give up a little bit on my sort of dreams of being a zoo vet and do wildlife work. But it was really rewarding. Like, I found it really quite enjoyable to do, and really great to work with the wildlife people that wanted to get these animals out. So I started to do that, and I sort of went through different practices, always sort of doing the wildlife work there. And then I was offered a position at the University of Sydney's Avian Exotic and Wildlife Hospital there. And I was there for 6 years. And I was able to teach students about wildlife and work with lots of incredible Australian animals. So I got to do a lot of koala work, which was really great, and I really enjoyed, and I have a soft spot for these guys. And, you know, I really enjoyed my time there. And then when the job came up for the Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital, I thought, you know, this is incredible. Like, the way that the ad was written, I thought it was basically written for me. Just everything about it was just nailed out. This is the perfect job for me. And, you know, there's not a lot of jobs in the world where you get paid to work with wildlife. So that was also quite a nice feeling to know that you can actually be appreciated and do that. And so I applied for it and met the co-founder of the hospital, and we got along really well. And then the rest is history. I moved my whole family up from Sydney to Byron Bay, and we've been here now for a year, and we're just enjoying the ride. It's great.
Yes, and I think that kind of what you said in the beginning is absolutely incredible. And I think the feeling that most of us have too, going through wildlife, is it is so rewarding. And I think not a lot of people realize that. And yes, there's not a lot of opportunities to get paid doing it, but just the feeling you get from working with wildlife is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And because when I was in normal practice, a dog, you know, dog and cat practice and mixed practice, yeah, I had to do a lot of this in my own time. So I would spend my lunch breaks doing it or stay after, but I didn't mind, because it is so rewarding. And that feeling that you get when you hear from the wildlife carers that the animal did get released and you played a little part in that, that is a really nice feeling. That's, you know, that makes you go, well, you know what, staying back made it all worth it. Or, you know, missing out on, you know, a bit of my lunch break was fine, because the animal gets a second chance out in the wild. And we are living alongside these animals. They deserve every chance to be in their natural habitat, because we're visitors in it, really, and we need to be able to work alongside them and live alongside them. And so I do think it's our duty to try and get these animals back out into the wild. And I know it's hard because no one pays us to do it, especially in Australia. We don't get a lot of government funding, or, you know, vets do it all pro bono. And so, you know, we lose money doing it, but I do think there is some reward in doing it, and we have a bit of an ethical and moral role to play in getting these animals out and doing that. But it's not to the detriment of our mental health. Like, you know, staying back all the time isn't great, but yeah, I find it really, you know, quite good to get them and help them and get them back out.
Yeah. And I didn't know that about Australia too. So just goes to show how even great of a character you are to be able to do that as well. So.
Yeah. I mean, after the bushfires, things have changed a little bit, but still it's not nearly where we should be compared to the rest of the world. So we've got a little bit of way to go.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that's coming soon.
Yep.
I would love to talk more about the story behind the establishment of Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital and just how incredible it is to have the capability to have this mobile hospital that's well-equipped for wildlife rehab. So do you mind just talking about the inspiration behind the hospital and what your job looks like at Byron Bay?
So the Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital was a dream of the two co-founders, Dr. Stephen Van Mill and Dr. Evan Kozak. And they're two local vets up here in the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales. And they were seeing a lot of wildlife coming into these general practices and not seeing that they were getting the care that they deserved, because just because of, you know, lack of time, lack of resources, lack of training. And so originally their plan was to make a bricks and mortar veterinary hospital, you know, just for wildlife in the Northern Rivers region, because where we are, it is one of the most biodiverse regions in New South Wales. And so we have a lot of unique species up here and habitats up here that need to be cared for and maintained. But then the catastrophic, you know, 2021 bushfires started, and they realized that, you know, seeing what happened there, there was a massive need for wildlife vet to go to the site of a bushfire and help those animals, just because some of the locations of the bushfires, you know, animals were traveling 2 to 3 hours to get to veterinary care or veterinary attention. And that can mean the difference between life or death for a lot of these animals. So they decided to reconfigure their dream to be a mobile hospital, so that they could drive it to the scene of a natural disaster. So they basically fundraised all over $1 million to build this wildlife hospital. And so they didn't get any government funding. They didn't get any massive, you know, donations from a big organization. They basically just went ground roots and appealed to people and just got out there and said, you know, we need to do this for the wildlife.
Can you imagine the absolute dedication and drive that must have taken to fundraise over $1 million on their own? That would be like if little Susie down the street sold over 200,000 boxes of Thin Mints in her pursuit of becoming the Girl Scout Queen. What an absolute amazing accomplishment, and such a beautiful way to use that money to help in such an important cause.
And this is the result. It's a 17.5 meter long truck that is fully equipped to go anywhere in Australia. It is self-sufficient. So it's got solar power. It's got an onboard generator. It's got all the bells and whistles of a normal veterinary hospital put on the back of a truck. And so I then came along as the foundation vet, and then I decked it all out with all the equipment that we would need for a wildlife hospital. So we've got digital x-ray, we've got ultrasound, we've got a fully functioning surgery room, we've got ICU cages and treatment tables, triage areas. And my day-to-day is never the same. So what we do at the moment is we are stationed in the Northern Rivers region. So this is our base, and animals can come to us, you know, from anywhere. So we'll get wildlife carers coming to us from several hours away to get treatment. We'll get animals that are transferred from other local vets to us, and then we'll get the wildlife carers coming in with their animals. And, you know, we could see a green sea turtle that might be next door to a brush-tailed possum, that might be next to a rainbow lorikeet, that, you know, then we might have a koala come in, or we might have a venomous snake come in. And basically all these animals get treated exactly the same as you would dog, cat, horse, you know, they get their triage, they get all their treatments, they get all the diagnostic workups that we think that they need. And then we organize their surgery if they require it, or if their medical management if they require it. And then we'll work with the local wildlife carers and the local vets in the area to then continue their treatment post veterinary consult. And then if there is a natural disaster, we can then pack up that truck. It takes us probably, we've got it down to, you know, 2 hours now to pack the whole thing up, and we can drive it wherever we need to. We then have a sister clinic that is a bricks and mortar hospital that we can then transfer our patients that we've got on board into there, so that we can then go and look after the animals there. So it's an interesting place to work, because you do forget that you're in the back of a truck sometimes. But it is small, so you have to get used to working in smaller areas and just organizing yourself to get around all the other staff members. But it is a unique experience, and it's quite enjoyable to work in.
Yeah, and that's honestly incredible that they had this big dream of theirs that they were able to fulfill, and then obviously it fit the need to follow your dream and kind of make this a reality as well. It's truly inspiring. I think it's an incredible story.
Yeah, it is pretty cool, because now what has happened is that there are governments and sort of veterinary and wildlife centres all around the world that are really interested in this concept. So, you know, we've now talked to some governments over in different states in Australia. New Zealand are quite interested in having something like this over there. And then in South Africa, that they want to have a wildlife hospital. So by doing this, it's showing that we can do it. There is the capacity to, you know, not have a bricks and mortar, which require so much, you know, government and council involvement, but the wildlife still win. So it's a really good feeling that knowing that something like this is inspiring other people to go, okay, let's think outside the box and let's see what we can do and, you know, make it reality when people have thought about it for so long. So it's quite cool.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, you touched on it a little bit already, so let's kind of shift gears here and talk about some natural disasters. So natural disasters have a huge impact on wildlife populations and their health. Can you start off by just talking about some of the major natural disasters that impact wildlife and the main effects these disasters have on their health?
So everyone knows that bushfires is probably the number one impact that, you know, can, you know, affect wildlife. And we saw that in Australia, and also in California, you guys have your wildfires over there. And so they can destroy habitat. They can destroy food sources for these animals. And then they can just change the wildlife corridors for a lot of these animals. But the other kind of natural disasters that people forget about are floods, and then drought. So especially in Australia, you know, we have had a major history of drought events. And so that causes a follow-on effect, because you're not going to have plants that can germinate. You know, we don't have enough water to then get those flowers to plant and then to germinate and then have their seeds or their pollens. And so you lose a lot of your food sources for those animals. But similarly with floods, it's the same thing. You lose the food sources, you lose the habitat and the housing of these animals, because they just actually get washed away. And then you change the soil types and the soil configuration when you have these wildlife disasters, or these natural disasters, sorry, because it's such their own little ecosystem, their own little habitat, that if you to change one little bit of it, it's a knock-on effect for everything else. And so it's just a crappy thing for wildlife, because the health isn't just for one generation. It changes it for the next generation of those animals. And so you might think that you might save one animal, but, you know, it's if it has had not enough nutrients, then it can't sort of be in the right body condition to then have offspring, or, you know, then to have enough fitness to, you know, ward off other animals from its territory. So it has a lot of effects on these guys that you don't even think about. You just think about the big thing of losing a house, but it's all these other things that, you know, affect these guys as well. So it's a very complex, and you can go into a bit of a wormhole when you start thinking about what happens to these animals. So, you know, you could probably talk for hours. I'll just go around in circles of all the things that would be going on with these guys.
Yeah, and I think that you brought up a kind of a good point, and the fact that when we obviously think about bushfires, that tends to be injuries and things that you can treat, you can see. And then when it comes to obviously the other things like floods and drought, those are very long-standing issues that are going to happen that you can't just fix overnight, and are kind of the problems that come down the line that are not visible to us. And I think that is something that's important for people to recognize, that there are such lasting effects with those as well on wildlife. And this truly is such an important point to get across, that it's so much more than just the immediate results or the initial consequences that come from natural disasters, because there are these other environmental sequelae that happen and create an even longer lasting effect. So even though the cameras are off and the public attention has faded away, the effects on the wildlife haven't. This means that people working with wildlife, whether it's in rehab, veterinary care, government work, whatever it may be, you need to still be aware that the need to help wildlife extends well beyond the initial natural disaster.
Yeah. And yeah, especially like in Australia, we've had so much drought that it's, you know, some of our little species, and people forget about too, like the reptile species. Everyone thinks about mammals, but you know, a lot of the reptile species, they get lost and people don't even realize that they've become extinct, or they've had such a generational loss that it's going to take years and years and years to get their population back up to a sustainable level that they can then reproduce and repopulate their species to a number that's going to stay sustainable. And so, you know, everyone thinks about the big cuddly things like kangaroos, koalas, but it's really important that we remember about these smaller species. And the other one that a lot of people forget about, especially in Australia, is our flying foxes. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people consider them being pests or consider them being disease-ridden, because we do have Australian bat lyssavirus virus and we do have Hendra virus. And so people don't tend to put a lot of significance on their impact and their role in the habitat, but we lose them in heat events. So in Australia, we get a lot of, I keep referring to Australia because that's what I know more of. You know, we do have a lot of heat events and we will lose flying foxes. They'll just drop out of the trees and die, and they'll abort their pups. But they're really important for germination of certain eucalyptus trees. So if we don't look after them and we don't, you know, keep their population stable, then we're going to lose them as our natural pollinators for our eucalypt trees. And then we're not going to have eucalypt trees for koalas. So you have to remember that, you know, you don't just save koalas. You've got to save the things that germinate their trees, and that's going to be our flying foxes. And so, you know, you've got to think of the whole big relationship. It's, you know, intimately related to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, kind of like you said, I'm sure we could go down a rabbit hole with all these things, but let's shift here to bushfires a little bit. So talking about bushfires, and let's talk about kind of the threat that they pose to wildlife. So I'm sure that most people kind of all over the world are well aware of the calamitous impact that Australian bushfires in particular have had on so many wild animals. Do you mind just discussing the impact that bushfires had on wildlife and how wildlife rehabilitation played a role in these fires, and touching just on the veterinary care aspect during that time as well?
So the bushfires back in 2020, the sort of black fires, they were enormous and they had a massive impact on how the world sees Australia and how we look after our wildlife. And unfortunately, it wasn't that great in some aspects of it. But it also did show in other aspects that we are very caring people, and that people all over the world will come to us to try and help for this wildlife. But basically, these bushfires got out of control and were disastrous. We lost probably, you know, the estimate is in the billions of species of animals, in wildlife. And that it does include our reptiles, includes our mammals. And so I think that one of the estimates was something like 3 billion animals. And some of those actually became extinct because, you know, we lost populations of animals in there, unfortunately. And so the wildlife rehab side of it was enormous, but I think it was good and bad, because people wanted to help these animals and we wanted to feel like we were doing something to make ourselves sort of feel better and feel like we're helping these animals. But potentially with some of the animals, that it might have been better for them to be put to sleep, to be euthanized, than to continue on, because I think people wanted to feel like they were doing something, but might have put some of these animals through some, you know, treatment that probably was a bit too much for them. So some of the koalas might have been better to be put to sleep because their injuries were just horrific. And that's no fault of anyone. Like, everyone just wanted to help. And so it's really shone a light on human behavior of looking after wildlife and what animals can be put through, but also the role that government and people play in trying to organise a response to this. And so everyone wanted to help, but it was really uncoordinated between the groups. So we had a lot of people coming from overseas coming in to help, but they didn't know anything really about Australian wildlife and their unique anatomy and physiology, but also the rules and regulations about looking after these animals and releasing them. And so Australia, each state has different regulations about what we're allowed to release and what we're not allowed to release and what has to be euthanized. And so that created a little bit of confusion and trauma psychologically to some people about what could happen. But, it also allowed veterinary care to go, okay, well, what can animals put up with and, you know, what can they actually, you know, handle?
Humane euthanasia is an option in veterinary medicine that can allow us to help an animal that is suffering, and it gives us the chance to assess what is truly in the best interest for that particular animal. But as Dr. Talbot mentioned, even though at times we can understand logically in our minds that humanely euthanizing an animal is in the best interest for their welfare, our hearts might not be caught up with our mind, and we can still carry that burden, especially if you're continually exposed to euthanasia and so many tragic cases. Then they kind of all begin to accumulate more and more weight on your shoulders. That is why in this profession, it is so important to be able to recognize that humane euthanasia comes with benefits and challenges, and that finding a healthy way to cope with euthanasia is vital in this career. If you are someone who struggles with euthanasia, please know that you're not alone, and I'm always here if you need to talk about it or just want another person for your support system.
And so there was one vet, actually, Dr. Michelle Campbell Ward, who is a zoo vet who then did or is actually doing some research on this, and she's actually done some post-fire surveys with wildlife carers and veterinarians about how did they feel like it, how it went, and, you know, what happened to these animals and what happened to the people that looked after it. And I suppose this is kind of not part of your question, but it's a really important part of it, because it showed that the veterinary care isn't just, like you said before, not just treating these animals and putting them back out, because a lot of these animals were in care for 9, 10, 12 months post-surgery, post-bushfires. And so it had this really long and complex follow-on from just in the bushfires, because bushfires can have positive and negative effects on wildlife. So if it's just a normal bushfire, they can be really important for the wildlife and really important for the habitat. So we've got certain flowers or certain trees like our banksias and eucalypts that need bushfires to germinate. So we need those to happen on a regular basis so that then our parrots and some of our marsupials can use those for feeding, to use them for housing, for drays and things like that. So we need to have those. But when they're in massive, massive, massive big events, then that's when it gets quite catastrophic. And that's what happened with these ones. And we weren't organized in terms of doing our habitat backburning and clearing of the trees. And so we actually weren't ready for this, because we just thought it was going to be a little bushfire. So there was lots of things that we realized that we weren't actually organized for. So it then, you know, created this kind of havoc and this kind of confusion. Everyone wanted to help, but it was really, really uncoordinated. And lots of animals, people lost track of where they went and what happened with them. But I'm not trying to make it sound all negative. Like, there was lots of really good stories and good feel-good stories from it, and it brought the community together. It brought the wildlife carers together, and it brought the veterinary teams together. But it was definitely a very stressful time for everyone during these bushfires. So it's a bit of a rabbit hole, because it showed or exposed how bad a bushfire can be and devastating effects it can have on people and wildlife.
Yeah, and I think I'm glad that you brought that up. Honestly, I think it is important to realize, and I think in a lot of aspects of veterinary medicine, the emotional toll it can have on the people who are doing it as well. And we all obviously care about animals. That's why we got into this field. And it can be very emotionally draining to do that, especially when things are maybe not going the way that we want them to. So I'm glad that you brought that to the forefront, for sure.
Yeah. It definitely, a lot of veterinarians did feel like they got burnt out because they were working so long, and they felt like they really had to, and wildlife carers as well, felt like they really had to put the effort in to save that animal, because the public wanted to see that animal survive, because they wanted to feel like, you know, something positive happened from the bushfires. And I think that put a massive mental strain on the veterinary professionals doing it. So, you know, we can kind of handle normal bushfires, but really, in a lot of these bushfires, not a lot of animals survived. So they came out and they were perished, and that had a mental toll. But, you know, we know that that's going to happen with some bushfires. And so, you know, when people really wanted us to try and help save them, I think that put a lot of extra stress on the professionals to try and help get these animals through when maybe we should have euthanized them. So it was is quite draining.
Yeah. Now, do you mind just either if there's a case maybe that kind of sticks out with you, or even just kind of in summary, some of the care that you provided to wildlife during these bushfires, kind of what that looked like more specifically, I guess?
Yeah, so the veterinary sort of care that we would do with these cases is a lot of them were burnt paws. So with the koalas, they had a lot of smoke inhalation. And so they would come in, they couldn't really breathe that well, and they were just quite lethargic. And, you know, essentially like if someone went into a burning house and you'd come out, then, you know, you're raspy and, you know, you've got singed hair, but these guys would have singed fur. But a lot of them weren't that obvious to start off with because you get the radiant burns. And so you'd think that they're okay, but after a couple of days, they would start to go downhill. And, you know, they would have, yeah, like the burnt paws, their burnt back, their burnt noses. And so a lot of it was trying to provide good pain relief for them. And so we would try to, as soon as they come in, we would try to give them some fluid therapy to try and rehydrate them. And then we would give them pain relief. And then basically, you know, you would put their paws in some warm water to try and clean it off really gently, and then sort of wrap them up and put padding on it so it wasn't so sore for them, because they couldn't, you know, koalas especially, you know, like to be able to hold on to stuff, you know, so they want to hold on to a trunk, but it's too sore to hold on to. So you'd have to put little bandages on them, but you have to change it regularly so that the skin that was sloughing off wouldn't go off and wouldn't sit there and make them feel even worse. But changing it regularly is sore for them. So you'd have to find like a really fine balance of treating them, but not pushing their bodies too far. And so, you know, we would do that on a regular basis.
Okay. Of course, I'm going to take this chance for a little learning opportunity, and let's chat briefly about the phases of wound healing. Now, this won't be all-encompassing for every aspect of this process, but it will go over some of the bigger aspects to know when it comes to wound healing. So first, we have the inflammatory phase, which is characterized by changes to the vascular permeability, chemotaxis, or essentially cell recruitment, and cell activation. This phase starts almost immediately after the injury occurs and usually lasts for about 3 to 5 days. Initially, we have these few moments of vasoconstriction where the blood vessel shrinks on itself, but then you have this transition into vasodilation where the blood vessel dilates or expands its volume, which can lead to edema or that fluid-like swelling you see around wounds. Important cells in this phase include platelets and certain types of white blood cells like neutrophils and macrophages. Platelets are important initially to organize that blood clot to prevent excessive bleeding, and then the platelets release these chemical mediators to help start that wound healing process. Neutrophils are the first white blood cell to arrive, and they help clear any bacteria, debris, and damaged cells, which can lead to that pus-like fluid you see with wounds. Macrophages are the white blood cells that arrive a little bit later to the party, and they're the predominant cell in wounds that are a few days old. Macrophages are incredibly important when it comes to the inflammatory phase, as they produce a lot of chemical mediators that help stimulate the formation of new blood vessels called angiogenesis, and they recruit fibroblasts, which are cells that help build the cellular components of the skin. Now, it is important to note that within the inflammatory phase, there is no gain in strength in the wound. Second is the proliferation or repair phase, which is characterized by that formation of the granulation tissue, or that healthy pinkish-red wound surface that provides the scaffold for the formation of new skin cells, called epithelialization. And this phase is where the wound area starts to gain strength back as collagen is deposited. This is where fibroblasts predominate, and they produce collagen to help form that granulation tissue and then the new skin surface through epithelialization, which sometimes in layman's terms is referred to as formation of a scab. A specialized type of fibroblast called a myofibroblast is also important in this phase of wound healing to start with that contraction or the decreasing size of the wound. Overall, this repair phase is typically occurring a few days after the insult until about 3 weeks or so later, but the timing is pretty variable and it depends on numerous factors. Lastly, we have the maturation or remodeling phase, and this is where the matrix from that repair phase transitions into that scar. This process leads to a decrease in cellularity of the area, but the collagen bundles become thicker, they change orientation, and they increase cross-linking to ultimately make them stronger. This whole process can take months to years to fully complete, depending on the location of the injury and then the type of tissue damaged. Now, it is important to remember that while there is this rough breakdown of when these phases of wound healing occur, most times there is this overlap between the phases. And just like most things in medicine, there's no hard and fast black and white distinction between the phases in a natural setting. But understanding these phases of wound healing are incredibly important because the phase of healing helps us choose how to better manage or treat the wound, and then if the wound is not healing as we normally would expect, then we need to explore what physical, environmental, or patient factors are impeding the wound from healing properly. All right, cool. Now that we've got this little journey through wound healing, let's jump back into the episode and I'll just slowly fade away back into the silence.
And the other thing that a lot of these guys got was renal failure. So a lot of people tried to put them in and rehydrate them too quickly because they want to try and get them out. But then we would see them. And so I would also converse with other clinicians around the place who were like, we've got this koala that's not looking that good. And would find out the history that they had, like, you know, a liter of saline or a liter of Hartmann's under an hour. And that's caused a fluid overload for these guys that sort of presented, you know, 48, 72 hours or even like a week later. And the koala wasn't going that well. And so trying to correct that. So I did a lot of that kind of telemedicine as well with a lot of the clinicians.
Hi, I'm back. But this time, instead of wonderful wound talk, let's talk about fluid overload and some of the badness that comes from letting those floodgates open. So let's try and put that liter of fluid given just 1 hour into perspective. If we think about just a maintenance fluid rate, meaning the amount of fluids estimated to maintain normal fluid balance in the body, we can think of a fluid rate for koalas fairly similar to what we might for a fluid rate in dogs, at least for the purpose of this exercise, which in this case would be about 60 mils per kilogram in a day. And just a caveat, I'm using this fluid rate as this is what was primarily taught at Michigan State. But there are a few other recognized ways of calculating maintenance fluid rate depending on where you trained. Anyway, for our koala example, that would mean a koala with, let's say, a weight of 22 pounds or 10 kilograms should get 600 milliliters within a 24-hour period just to maintain normal daily fluid balance. So if this same koala got 1 liter or 1,000 milliliters of fluid in just 1 hour, then the koala is getting well over what it needs for an entire day in just 1 hour. Even when a patient comes in on an emergency basis, and let's say they have this major fluid deficit, such as hypovolemic shock, or this life-threatening condition where there's this sudden loss of significant blood or fluid volume, and it's impairing the ability to get blood to their tissues, you still would likely give just a bolus of fluid, around 10 to 20 mils per kilogram, so about 100 to 200 mils for this koala, and it would be given over 15 minutes, and then you'd stop and reassess the need for fluid after that. So even if it was an emergent situation like that, a whole liter of fluid is a heavy fluid overload for a koala to handle, and one of the primary organs that suffers from the fluid overload are the kidneys. Therefore, with overzealous administration of intravenous or IV fluids, it's possible to cause an acute kidney injury, or AKI, where the kidney's function suddenly becomes compromised or they go into renal failure, which can have devastating and potentially life-threatening complications. An additional complication with overzealous IV fluid administration to note for the veterinary professionals listening in is disruption to the endothelial glycocalyx. This glycocalyx is this carbohydrate protein mixture that coats the vascular endothelium, which is that internal surface of the blood vessels. So essentially, picture this gel-like coating on the inside of a pipe. The research surrounding the role of the endothelial glycocalyx in both human and veterinary medicine is ever growing, but the glycocalyx plays a vital role in vascular health. Some specific roles of the glycocalyx include 1, regulating the vascular permeability or helping control what can and cannot pass through the blood vessel wall, 2, regulating the interactions between the blood vessel wall and then the cells within the blood, such as your red and white blood cells and platelets, and then 3, helping to maintain this homeostasis or the body's internal balance state in times of disease. Now, the glycocalyx could be a whole episode on its own, but for the scope of this episode, it's important to recognize that high rates of fluid administration can lead to damage of this endothelial glycocalyx. If it helps you to picture that pipe again with that gel-like coating, if you suddenly allow for a rapid gush of fluids to flood the pipe, you're blowing this gel-like coating right off the pipe. Therefore, even a healthy patient being given an overzealous amount of fluids very well could have a damaged endothelial glycocalyx and subsequent compromised vascular health. So then if we add on injury or disease that all of our patients in hospital will have, and now we've got this recipe for potential disaster, and you can kiss that glycocalyx goodbye. And now I'll say goodbye, but don't worry, just with my words, not with my lips. And then let's hear what the rest of this episode has to offer.
And then trying to get them to feed. And then also a lot of it too was talking to the public about what you can do to feed animals. So we had a lot of people trying to put food out for them because they thought that's the best thing to do, but they were putting the wrong food out. So then I was with a working group of other veterinarians and zoo professionals of trying to put out information that was appropriate for the species that they would be looking for. So, you know, in combination of doing the actual treatment side of it, we also had to do the public perception side too of trying to get the animals out. So the animals that did survive, which there wasn't a lot of, it was treating what we could. So mainly I was helping with the koalas, of trying to get them comfortable, trying to get their wounds managed. But, you know, they're long-term animals. You know, if you're lucky, there was a few that you could get out, because, you know, koalas are going to go to the top of the trees. That's where they're going to go. So depending on how intense the fire was, you would either, you know, they'd just be singed on the back, or they'd just be burnt on their paws. Or if the intensity of the fire was really, really bad, then, you know, they would have smoke inhalation, they would have burns, and so actually sort of burns internally, then you'd have to treat them with bronchodilators and bronchoprotectants and just really, really careful fluid management, and then just see how they go. And then if they didn't respond, then we'd have to make a plan if it was worth it or not. And then you had like your possums that would sort of come in. Some of those didn't get too badly affected because they would go into, say, like a hole in the tree, or they would make, you know, like a tree trunk sort of dray, and so they would only get their backs burnt. And then a lot of your wombats, they would dig burrows, and so, you know, they kind of got out of it a little bit. A lot of your birds could fly away, but the ground-dwelling birds, they just perish. So there wasn't that much you could do with those ones, unfortunately. So it was sort of your biggest species that we could look after. But then also a lot of the, say, the kangaroos, they would try and jump away, but then get caught in fences. So get caught in, because we've still got a lot of barbed wire here. And so, you know, they would get caught. And so you'd have to then handle the fence injury as well as the fire injury. And so a lot of those guys didn't make it either. So there's a lot of heartache in a lot of that, because, you know, there's not a lot you could do for a lot of these animals.
Yeah. And just all the multiple layers to these injuries and things that these animals are presenting to is, it's a lot. And so I can imagine it being very challenging. And I think any of us in veterinary medicine who've worked with any animal that's had wounds or burns or anything, that the process is long. It takes a long time to see how that's kind of declare itself and just to take care of those until they can finally heal up.
And especially being a wild animal too, they don't let you handle them as well as, say, like a dog or a cat would, even though no one's going to let you really handle them that well when they're burnt and they're sore. they're scared of you. They're stressed because they're not in their normal environment. They're stressed because they're not getting their normal food intake. They're stressed because, you know, they've actually, you know, you can't say that, well, we don't know that there's no psychological effect of the fires on them, you know. So they've got all these other things on top of them, not just the burns. And so, you know, you're not just, like you said, not just dealing with one thing. It's a lot more difficult for a wild animal compared to a dog or cat. And so you've also got to think of that as, you know, should I do this to this animal? Is this fair to put this animal through this when it's not just the burns and not just the smoke inhalation and not just this or not just that they're dealing with? You've got to really be the animal's advocate and think long term. And that can be hard for some people to do, because you're just looking at what's in front of you.
Yeah. And even too with things like smoke inhalation, how we know in dogs and cats, how that can lead to chronic bronchitis or asthma or things like that. We just don't know kind of the data on that with wildlife. And that's certainly something, again, like you're saying, thinking about the longstanding issues to make sure we're putting the animal's welfare first, even if it's just in that kind of acute setting.
Yeah, exactly. And you kind of, yeah, exactly. Like, we don't know the long-term effects of what some of this does to these wildlife. You know, like, we don't even know in a normal setting, not even, you put bushfires aside, we don't really have any data on how many of these animals survive post-veterinary treatment when they go back out into the wild, because, you know, you'd have to get either satellite tracking, or, you know, having chips in them to, you know, track them and know what happened to them. So in a normal everyday thing, when it's just a displacement, or it's just, you know, a cat fight wound or something like that, we don't know if these animals go out and then die 3 days later, you know. So to know then what happens to these bushfire animals when they've had such a long time in care and such horrific injury to them, we don't have that data yet on if all of this was worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think one of the bigger questions then is, what can we do about this? And is there anything that we can do to kind of mitigate events like bushfires from happening again or other natural disasters? So I guess, how are you and the staff at Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital preparing your team, as well as then educating the public, for helping wildlife during these natural disasters?
Yeah, so we actually partnered with World Animal Protection earlier last year, and we made some educational videos about how members of the public and wildlife carers can organize themselves in terms of getting ready if there is a bushfire. So how you can get your dogs and cats out of your property properly, how you can look after your horses, you know, if there is a fire, but also what to do if you find injured wildlife or if there is a bushfire coming and you know that there's wildlife there. So we worked with them to provide those videos so that people can access them at any time. And we're also very big on our education of the public of, you know, how you can help wildlife, how you can make up natural habitats around your house, how you can also, you know, keep your around your house sort of debris free, so that wouldn't, you know, if a fire does come up, you know, it's not going to come up and go into your eaves of your house, and, you know, so you want to get rid of all of your leaves from your gutters and things like that, and, you know, how we can make sure that the habitat around our house, around our parks and things like that, have got natural trees in them, and we are still having our wildlife corridors so that we're not doing more habitat destruction, and so the animals can actually flee if they need to and it's a clear path. But we really need to work with governments and we need to work with councils about how we can safeguard these animals for future fires. And so after these fires, governments have realized that they need to do something, and so they're trying to, but they've got to figure out their political sides that they're working on. They've got to figure out funding. And so it's not that easy going, okay, well, you know, we're just going to fix this and it's going to be great, because there's so many more things that, you know, as the public and as disability professional, we don't see that going on. But from in terms of Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital, we are really trying to work with organisations that have the same vision with us and want to try and do habitat restoration, that want to try and do education. And, you know, every day when we're talking to members of the public, we're trying to let them know, you know, what you can do around the house, what you can do as an individual to try and help wildlife. If it is a bushfire, if it is a flood, if it is a drought, how you can help in a positive way for these animals. And that's something that we will all always keep working on, and we'll also learn as individuals ourselves what's going to work and what's not going to work. And so every day we'll just keep trying to help people understand and learn and empower them to go, okay, well, I can do something about this and I can try and help. And so it's, you know, we want to be there too. We want them to know that if they need to, our truck can go wherever we need to help them. And so last year, actually, there was some bushfires in Western Australia. And so we contacted the local governments there and sort of said, we can come over if you need to. And so we just want to let people know that we're available. They didn't need us to go over there in the end, which is good. But, you know, we want people to know that we're there too. So we're trying to do things on a day-to-day basis that we can help our local people and people through social media, but then also helping organisations and governments. And so we're trying to work closely with them and let them know that we're here to help in whichever way we can do that for the wildlife.
Yeah. And I think, like you had talked about earlier on as well, is one of the bigger things that you noticed from the last time dealing with bushfires was the lack of preparedness or collectiveness with the whole team in general. So definitely doing things like this and helping people, including the public, be prepared for this, hopefully will minimize that for the next time, because unfortunately there probably will be a next time.
Yeah.
And kind of just helping in that way, and hopefully it will go smoother and we can save even more animals that way as well.
Yeah. And there are sort of higher up government or higher up organizations that are trying to do more preparedness strategies. And so hopefully they will then, you know, ask us for input or ask us to help, and we will have a bit more of a a collective sort of vision going forward. So they did actually do a bushfire preparedness little program through our TAFE, which is kind of like a higher education organization. And so all of the wildlife carers and vet professionals were able to do it for free. And so at least that's something now, but it's post bushfire, but at least they've realized that they needed to do it. So at least that's something that you could do. So it's talked about working in a bushfire environment, working about how we can do backburning to decrease the fuel that is in the area. And then, you know, also just looking after yourself mentally. So they, it's a start, but we do need more. And hopefully, you know, Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital can be there to help with our knowledge and expertise and also our passion for it. And we can make some positive impacts in the wildlife.
Okay. Well, as we wrap up this episode here, then there are usually two questions I like to ask my guest hosts. So what are some of the main points to remember about responding to natural disasters such as bushfires? And is there any advice or wisdom that you would like to share with any veterinary professionals listening to this episode?
I think it's sort of going back to some of my other points. I think one of the main points to remember about responding to a natural disaster is to ensure that you are mentally right to do it in the first place, ensuring that you have a good support system that can help you, because, you know, you think you're going in there to do a simple job, but it's actually far more complex, and making sure that you have all the right tools. So making sure you have the correct PPE, making sure that you have the right veterinary treatment sort of triage bag that you can take in that can give you the best chance of helping those animals that you can help, but also having the knowledge that you're not going to be able to help every animal, and euthanasia is never a bad thing. You know, having a dignified death or dignified passing is better than laying there suffering or laying there in a hospital when you're stressed and you're not in your normal place. You know, don't underestimate the power of stress in a wild animal. And so, because that can impede healing. So my wisdom would be, make sure that you're prepared mentally, physically, have your support system, and then do it because you want to do it, but know when to say, I've had enough and I need to have a break. I need to get off, because even euthanizing, even though it's a nice dignified death, that is heavy as well. And so it is, you know, because you can go into your veterinary heart and you can go into your veterinary brain very quickly and you can do that and look after those animals. But it's the other side that I think people forget about. And, you know, as we all know, you know, veterinarians have one of the highest suicide rates, and something like this is heavy for people. And, you know, you need to know that you are supporting yourself and you've got a good support system. So I don't think I need to really talk about the veterinary side of things, because everyone can do that. It's the other part that people forget about or think is not that significant when it is.
Absolutely. I think very, very incredible points there, and applicable across the board, wherever you work in veterinary medicine, whether it's wildlife, zoo, small animal, large animal, wherever it is, that's very good words of wisdom. So thank you.
We're very, very giving people. We, you know, we want to help and we want to show that we can do this. You know, we're all the type A personalities. We want to be able to be the best at it and we want to be able to help every animal. But I think over my years of being a vet and being a wildlife vet especially, I think you need to learn that sometimes you can't help every animal, and it is better to give them that nice ending than to put them through suffering. And, you know, I think that's a bit of a light bulb moment when you can know that you can't save every animal. It's the same with the bushfires. You're not going to be able to save them. Or with a flood, you're not going to be able to save them. Or the drought. Drought is just draining on everyone's soul. And so I think if you know that you can look after yourself, you can be a better vet if you look after yourself first, and then you can do a better job of looking after the animals. And it's applicable in a bushfire and any other natural disaster as well.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much again, Dr. Talbot, for joining me on this episode to discuss natural disaster response and the role wildlife rehab plays in all of it. It certainly is a hot topic, and I hope the information you provided sparks passion and preparedness and extinguishes the impact of future disasters. You have truly inspired myself, and I hope you inspire many people listening, as well as just your job and the mission of Byron Bay. So thank you again.
No, thank you for having me.
Thank you everyone for listening in, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. For updates on upcoming episodes and additional information on all things wildlife, zoo, aquatic, and exotics, follow us on Instagram at walkonthewildside_vetpodcast, like us on Facebook, or visit our website. If you liked what you heard, we'd love for you to give us a great rating on your podcasting platform. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us through our social media pages or by email at walkonthewildsidepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you join us for the next episode of A Walk on the Wild Side.